You are listening to The Beckett Cook Show with your host, Beckett Cook. For more information about Beckett and his ministry, visit his website at beckettcook.com. To help support the podcast, visit patreon.com/The Beckett Cook Show. Please consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a 5-star rating.
Hey guys, welcome to the Beckett Cook Show. I'm Beckett Cook, and today I have a very special guest. Her name is Tracy Camilla Johns, and she was the star of Spike Lee's first feature-length film in 1986 called She's Gotta Have It. And she has a very powerful story, and we're going to get into her whole life story basically today. So welcome, Tracy Camilla Johns.
Thank you, Beckett. I am very excited to be here. You probably hear that a lot, but I so am.
Thank you. I'm so glad you're here. So let's start at the beginning. You were born in Queens, right?
Yep. Actually, Hollis, Queens. For those who are not fully versed in New York background, that is the home of Run DMC, Salt-N-Pepa, and Tracy Camilla Johns. Wow.
So you were destined to be involved in some sort of artistic stuff.
Yeah.
And so growing up, what was your family like? Were you raised Christian? Like what was the deal?
My family background's a little interesting. My mother was raised Roman Catholic from the South. They're both very much alive, my mom and my dad, but my mom was raised Roman Catholic from the pretty deep South. My dad was raised in New York and varied from agnostic to atheist. So when we grew up, we spent a couple of years in and out of Catholic school, which was pretty much the bulk of my Christian exposure, with the exception of my great grandmother, who was this amazing woman from the islands. She was I didn't understand it then, but she loved Jesus. She loved Jesus. And she really was the only person probably in my first 14 years, even apart from the Catholic school snippets, who really talked to me about Jesus and Jesus loving me. And I have these really incredible memories of sitting on her bed with my legs like swinging because I was that small. And she had this picture of Jesus that you've seen all over the world. And she'd have the palm on the wall and she'd have the ashes on Ash Wednesday because she was Episcopal. So they were very parallel to Catholicism, but she was different. She was really full of a certain kind of faith and expression about Christ that she really was the only person who talked that way. And then what was really interesting was many years later, when I actually came to Christ, I recalled seeing different ministers on her TV. But like back then, I never connected the dots. But as I became more a study of the gospel and learned about different Pentecostal ministers and different, you know, just outbreaks of the spirit, I was like, I used to watch them on grandma's TV. But like there was no understanding. And then all these very vivid memories came back about, I used to watch them on TV and that was what grandma had going on. So I know that that was really the seed that held me through a lot of really mad times.
Yeah. And so as you were growing up in Queens, I mean, was that kind of faith kind of sticking with you, or were you just kind of, did you just put it on the back burner and do your own thing?
The only thing that I can, the true testimony is I believed in God. I believed that there was God. I couldn't explain it. And as I got older, and I was always a creative person, so I went from art school because I actually went to Fashion Institute. My intended major was illustration. So when I became, you know, the whole college decision, I literally had to sneak to get in because my dad and my mom are both very, my dad is a retired attorney. My mother has a PhD in gerontology. We came from a very, you know, you go to school, you do something profitable. You're a young Black woman, you're intelligent, you know, the world is really before you in a way that it wasn't for us. And I was the artist, I was the flake. But my parents, you know, I went to see Broadway theater all the time and I used to cut school to go to the museum. And the whole creative person in me was really fed. And then when it was time to make decisions, they were like, no, you're going to get a teaching degree. You're going to do something rational that's going to pay your bills and you're going to have a roof over your head. So my mother did aid and abet the entrance into FIT. She did sneak me into classes enough to get a portfolio, with certain kindred spirits there. But I was absolutely no particular ties to religion. Once we got out of Catholic school in seventh grade, between my artistic pursuits and then because I would say I was fast, you know, some of the protection, because we were not a Christian household, but we were a household with a lot of rules. As soon as I started getting the train into the city, like by myself, and when I went to FIT and I was 17 when I graduated high school, it was like this whole world opened up to me. And I'm talking, it wasn't drugs and rock and roll, but it was like drugs and club music and designers. And I walked for Michael Kors before Michael Kors was famous, you know, when he had like a 6-piece yeah. series for this particular season. And he had a little tiny studio off of 7th Avenue. So I just really took a very deep headfirst dive into a culture that just had a lot of excesses. And I loved everything about it.
And then, so how did you get into acting?
In my artistic pursuits, I had a theater class, one of my electives, and I love to write, always have, and I'm pretty proficient at writing. And I wrote this monologue for my final project. And when the monologue was performed, the whole class was in tears, including the teacher. And he said these very fateful words, "If you ever decide to pursue acting or theater instead of art, I will back you all the way." And the next day I bought backstage and I started pounding the pavement. I wouldn't say necessarily flighty, but I really was a person who believed and had instilled in me that you can be anything. So of course they didn't really expect me to go off what they thought was the deep end, but I did go there. And I just needed a little bit of provocation because once again, I was tapping into so many things that were new to me, a lot of very corrupt things, but I was just so fascinated by this whole crazy, mad world. And I liked, you know, the attention. I liked the little bit of runway I did. And so when it went from runway to trying to get an acting job, I was like, well, I'm either going to get it or I'm not, but I'm definitely going to go ahead and try it.
And so how did you land the role of Nola Darling in Spike Lee's movie, She's Gotta Have It? How did that happen?
So this is a really interesting story. And then when you kind of reflect these many years later, you know, the hand of God is something amazing. I don't necessarily think that he wanted me to go through many of the things that I went through, but you know, he knows the beginning and the end. So he knew it was going to ultimately bring me to my knees. So in this big, bold, brazen, you know, it's going to happen to me or it's not going to happen. I was like, I'm not waiting tables for 10 years. I'm going to work. So immediately I got extra work, which is not that difficult. But the people that I encountered in my first two extra jobs were, I did Beat Street. I don't know if you know that movie. It was like the original rap movie when that culture was just being really exposed to some of the world, let alone the whole yeah. world. And Stan Lathan directed it. Stan Lathan is a very prolific director, and Sanaa Lathan is his daughter, who is a very successful Black actress. And there were people involved in that project that really have become really powerful in the industry as much as Blacks are in the industry, because there's still a lot of disparity there. But I think within 6 months of my first extra job, and I literally was like person in a crowd scene, nothing that even you could probably pick me out for. There was this ad for a movie called The Messenger. And it was this NYU College of Film graduate named Spike Lee. Now, there was no Spike Lee understanding prior to that. And I never forget assuming that Spike Lee was going to be like this white guy with studs on his neck, you know, some like cool downtown type. I really did from Tisch School of the Arts. It was so funny. And there's no visual to know. I just show up at this audition for the screen test. And it's this little wiry guy that is, you know, the younger version of the Spike Lee that we have all come to know. And I was so baffled, but I actually screen tested for that job. And I was about as raw as they get, but I won the role. We went into pre-production, but the day we started rehearsals, the production folded, and I was devastated because I had fulfilled, you know, my big declaration to everybody that this is going to happen to me in a year, or it's not going to happen at all. And I told the world that I knew that I was getting ready to shoot this first film, and then there was no film. And I was, once again, young, full of myself, knew everything and really knew nothing. And I was mad at Spike. I was mad at the world. And I stopped talking to him immediately. And I got a job with the Negro Ensemble Company, which is really the most famous Black professional theater company in the country. And at that time, they were the birthplace of A Soldier Story, which was a very successful movie that a lot of very famous actors were at that time. Little, not as well known, but a lot of people birthed out of that particular film production. And that particular tour took me on my real first professional job since the movie had folded. I went on a 6.5 month tour. I did professional theater for the first time. I worked with Ruben. I feel like I'm name dropping, but there's like these wonderful people that at that time were little known except within the arts community. And they all really just had crazy, wonderful lives in theater. So Ruben Hudson, who is an actor and director and producer and writer, Keith David, I'm looking right at him, who's a character actor, has done a ton of movies. And I worked with these really incredible theater vets who helped me really only foster the love for the industry. But the flip side of that was I was, you know, full of myself, and I was doing a lot of drinking at the time because that was just the celebration. It was just, you know, every night there was somebody there to buy you drinks or somebody was sending me flowers backstage. And I was just totally sucked up in the attention and just everything that was excess in that lifestyle. So Spike was on the back burner because I was pissed at him.
But wait, let me just ask you, why did She's Gotta Have It? Why did it fold initially?
No, it was the Messenger. It wasn't She's Gotta Have It.
Okay.
It was I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. The first film was a film called Messenger.
Right. Okay. Sorry.
That was the story of a bike messenger, which at that time were really huge in New York. There's like this whole subculture of the bike messenger. And Spike's younger brother actually worked as a bike messenger for many years. And that kind of is part of the Mars Blackman character, that the guy on the bike in the She's Gotta Have It movie. Like so many of his life experiences are morphed into a lot of the characters, particularly in his first films. So he kept in contact with me, but I was, you know, I was on the road. I was doing this play and you failed me and, you know, kiss my bottom. But when I came back to New York, what I will give him is he was persistent. He was like, Tracy, I'm writing the script and you're the lead in this one. This is for you. I've created this with you in mind. And I was like, yeah. So his famous meeting place at the time was Pizzeria Uno in the Village at that time on West 4th Street. And we met, we had the infamous meeting where he hands me the script and She's Gotta Have It. And I was still trying to play hard to get, you know, that. He talked to me very kindly and I took the script home. And this is pre-cell phone for real. So from my mother's phone in Queens that had just gotten beyond rotary dial, I pressed the numbers and I said, I want to do this.
Wow. And that was it. Yeah. And so, the screenplay, the movie is pretty racy, right? It's tell us about kind of the themes of the movie or what your character was about.
Well, She's Got a Habit. The character, it was Nola Darling. And she was this young woman who had, in this particular movie, she had three boyfriends or three lovers. And his particular focus and intent at the time was the fact that he felt that women were not represented fairly and that he knew well that all of his male friends, you know, dated, and I don't know, is multiplicity a real word, but, you know, they dated in mass number and it was cool with guys, but women were judged. But he knew a lot of women who really did date multiple men. And he felt that that's something that he wanted to express. But for me, it was great because I was very in the early stages of, you know, being exploratory. I was out of the parents' house and, you know, a lot of rules that were established had long been broken. And, you know, I was very strong-willed and everything that I had said that I wanted was really literally unfolding ahead of me. So I had like no fear and no shame about anything. When I look back on it now, I do it. You always kind of shake your head, but your other self, you go, but yeah, I had no fear whatsoever and dared anybody to say anything to me. So we do this film. It takes 2 weeks to do because that's what we had budget for.
Yeah. The budget was like $175,000, right?
$175,000 running from the police in Brooklyn, in the park, no permits, no nothing. This is true bootleg guerrilla filmmaking.
Right.
And we had, now Spike, of course, and I believe him though, that he testifies that he knew it was going to be all that. My hopes were, but at that point in time, I was just happy I was doing this first film. No one to me, maybe besides Spike, really had any idea that it was going to be what it was, not only launch his career really fully, but for $175,000 and really almost a year of editing, because it kept on getting held by the editing lab because he would run out of money. And he really did sell tube socks on St. Mark's Place. And I really did sign t-shirts there next to him to try to, we were usually crowdfunding before there was crowdfunding. We crowdfunded on St. Mark's Place in the village.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what was it like doing the movie? I mean, was it a great experience for you? Was Spike great? Like what was it like?
For an actor, it was invigorating. It was really exciting. So many of my experiences are rooted in my lack of knowledge of anything I entered into. So to be kind of thrust in that position and really have no understanding other than this is something I want to do. It was pretty amazing. Worked with a lot of wonderful people, Ernest Dickerson, a number of people actually that worked with Spike on that film still work with him, because just recently I did a cameo for him. And it was really amazing to see people that I had not seen in 33 years, literally.
Wow.
That was still in relationship with him. So the actual experience was everything that I'm sure somebody wanting to get involved in it and really didn't have any understanding that really there's so many more things happen when you're unionized and there's money and there's a studio backing you. But it was a very unique experience. We went to Cannes to the film festival. So in the space of less than 2 years, I was in the south of France, you know, walking the streets and on the beach and like intermingling with people that were like my wildest dreams of getting to meet. And it was just a really phenomenal ride, but it also then fueled everything that really almost brought me to not being here at all.
And so, by the way, just so people know, just if there are some people who don't know who sure. Spike Lee is, he directed not only She's Gotta Have It, but then he went on to do Do the Right Thing. And what are some mm-hmm. other like big films that people would recognize?
Do the Right Thing. Inside Man was the one that did like the hugest crossover initially that had Clive, Clive Barnes and Denzel Washington. But in between, God, Spike has such a history of movies. Everything from Clockers to He Got Game. I'm going back. I mean, he has such a wealth of movies. I mean, he's just won his first Academy Award within the last 3 years. But Spike has quite a library.
And he did recently the Klansman movie. Like it was called.
He did Black Klansman, and he also did The Five Bloods, which is one of Chadwick Boseman's last films. That was the Vietnam vet movie with the guys that go back to basically trace the path of the life of their friend who was Chadwick Boseman's character, who actually was killed in Nam. So he has quite a library of films and has been very, very successful.
Yeah. And so you get back from Cannes Cannes in France and you get back to New York. And so what happens after that?
Come back to New York. When the movie was actually released, it was, you know, this was an art film, art house type of distribution. So we were only in two theaters, but for literally about 3 months, there were lines around the block of the theaters before there was a wider release. And I have scrapbooks. It's funny, my parents recently moved from New York, and in the process of their move, like 50 years of their children's history was delivered on our doorsteps. And I have things that I'd forgotten even about. They had scrapbooks and And just the wealth of articles, everything from Newsweek to the New York Post to the New York Times to the Washington Post to magazines that some don't even exist anymore overseas. So it was just such a rush and a whirlwind of attention and fame before there was the internet. So this is like a whole nother level to have had the visibility that we had. And it was not because it was the click of the computer. It was just literally press and film and TV media coverage. It was pretty, it wasn't overwhelming. I think that's fair to say. It was a rush. It opened doors for me to meet people that I'd always wanted to meet. But I was very much more social than I was a thespian, which is just the real truth. So I kind of got caught up in the social part, which brought me to like a resounding crash.
Yeah. And what did your parents think of the movie? After they saw it, what did they think?
It's really pretty deep. As much as I was missed, you know, you can't tell me anything. And they were just kind of, you know, like, we know this is Tracy. I went to one of the screenings of the movie right before it was released with my mom and my dad, and all my boneness went right out the door. Cause it's like me, you know, it's like my whole body everywhere. And you're still kind of going, but they were extremely proud because they understood that it was about to be something big. Do I ever say that they were fully comfortable with seeing my bottom beyond my diapers in that manner? I don't know. But, you know, we got through it. And then some of it was, you know, they were happy for me. And at that point in time, I really hadn't self-destructed. So there were a lot of positive things seeming to come out of it. My mother is much more the prude. My dad, you know, was very, you know, didn't believe in God. He had a lot of different feelings having to do with his own upbringing. So he was probably, and not that he doesn't love me very deeply, he was probably less restrictive of the overall opinion of things. My mother was okay as long as I seemed to be okay until I wasn't.
Did your grandmother see it?
No, she was already passed.
Okay.
Oh, no, that great.
She would not. She would have not. Yeah.
She was the one who was watching. She was watching Catherine Coleman. You know, I mean, my great grandmother was like spirit filled firebrand from Barbados. Yeah. She would have probably put me under the ground then prematurely.
And so you say you kind of spiraled out of control. So what happened after the movie?
A lot of people don't know as much, except for people that are real followers of what career I did have. But I did New Jack City, which is another cult film. It was a cult hit. And to this day, I mean, now it's funny part because I meet kids. I'm 58. I meet children who are like huge fans of everything from the 80s and the 90s. And they're so fascinated with the whole following of New Jack City. But New Jack City, I played a stripper. It's like I went from, I just dove further down because and I once again, because at that point in time, you couldn't tell me anything. And I didn't really realize how the clock was ticking. So I get cast in this movie, and literally they reached out to me and said, "Hey, we want you to do this. She's this stripper. She's, you know, she's Wesley Snipes' woman, and she's da 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 da." And actually it wasn't Wesley Snipes' movie. I actually end up leaving Alan Payne. And Alan Payne, who was one of the stars of the movie, we were childhood friends. We both worked at Macy's for a season. And we talked about, you know, how we were going to become actors and actresses and stuff. And I had not seen him in the whole time that these things had happened to me. And at that point, his career was rolling. He had been on Cosby. He'd done a number of feature films. And it was this great reunion of these two young people who used to work in Macy's and fantasize about becoming actors. But that was the one that really, you couldn't tell me anything. You know, I didn't have to wipe my bottom. You use tissue to wipe your bottom, do you? Like, I was fabulous and amazing and nothing was wrong. But I went from like wine coolers used to make me buzzed. I went from wine coolers to like 7 sea breezes. And for those who don't know, we're talking like vodka, strong vodka drinks with like a dash of grapefruit.
I remember sea breezes. I had many of them when I was in high school. Yeah.
So like 7 and 8 gave me the same buzz a wine cooler used to give me. And I was an ecstasy fan. I was never a great weed puffer before it was legal because I didn't know how to inhale properly. I was a horrible smoker because I didn't ever figure out how to inhale without choking. But pills were good and alcohol was good. And I love to dance and I love the feeling of dancing high. So what started out as really for more entertainment value really became addictive. And I was horrendous. I was really not to be trusted as far as, you know, any person's man or your man or my man was fair game. And because I was the girl from the movie. So between the people who actually did approach me, you know, and my head got fatter and fatter, and those that based on me saying I wanted to meet them and, you know, arrange it, I was just totally out of control.
Wow. And so how long did this go on? How this out of controlness?
This the out of controlness took me from New York to LA because I did move to LA. I moved to LA in 87 that spring. And I just ripped my girlfriend says, you ripped your drawers. I ripped my drawers straight through LA for about 2 years. And in that time, I was still coming in and out of the country for a while there. I had a lot of attention overseas because it was huge. She's Got a Habit was huge in Italy and huge in London and even smaller places. And I love to be photographed and I love to, you know, go dance in a different place. And when I got to LA, I was doing a bunch of auditioning, but I wasn't booking a lot of jobs. I booked an episode of Family Ties, which was totally away from the whole sex, you know, this Black American ingenue, you know, wanting to be sex symbol thing. And it was funny because I adored Family Ties. I adored Michael J. Fox. It was such a dream come true. And it was such a contradiction to this whole persona that I was living and had created. And that really was like my happiest job. I spent a week on set with Michael J. Fox and Meredith Baxter Burney. And it was just like, oh my God. And I wanted to be, all of a sudden, I wanted to be recognized to be something that I had worked so hard to not be. And apart from Allison Jones, who's the person who cast me in that, who for some wonderful thing was able to look through the sex symbol and say, no, we're going to make you one of Mallory's college friends. And you're going to be like Goofy and Valley Girl. And it never happened again, though, after that. It was like, literally, I could not buy a job. But some of that was too, because in my knowing everything and being a smart mouth and big britches, as we call it, I would make these great declarations about, you know, I wasn't going to sleep with anybody for a job. And just, you know, the nature of the industry, I wasn't doing any favors. If I wanted to do something, I was doing it because I wanted to. It wasn't going to be about a job. And I definitely talk trash about people in positions of authority. And because lips talk, you know, and it's very cutthroat anyway, you're already competing against, you know, 17 other yous. And then you're talking trash about casting directors or people in positions to produce movies. And I spiraled down here very quickly. And that with the fact that I also was abusing substances, it was a very quick crash. But if I might be a little long-winded here and say, in that same span of time, I've been introduced to this really amazing woman who I did not know was going to be really critical to this all coming together.
And well, so who was this woman?
She was a young lady named Carla Fillinganes. She was then the wife of a really amazing man in the music industry. But I met her through a mutual friend. And she was this, if there was ever like a cool person in LA, she always wore sweats. She always wore these white tennis shoes and like a t-shirt. She wasn't flashy. She was beautiful physically, not a stitch of makeup. Everything about her was gold. Her hair was like sandy blonde. Her eyes were hazel. Her champagne jag was champagne. But she was like so down to earth. She was born deep in the valley. Loved the Lord. And the thing was, I had only had one other experience with somebody who loved the Lord in this time that really witnessed to me. And like I said, I believed in God. But I was like, you have no idea who I am. When people would say something to me about Christ. I have to kind of backtrack. The person that preceded her was this beautiful woman in Brooklyn who was actually the godmother of an old boyfriend. And for the sake to protect the innocent and the guilty, I'll just say she's still alive. And we have been gloriously reunited. And it was an answered prayer. But when she first met me, I was doing like horrific things with her godson. And she was like, Jesus is going to use you. And I was like, do you have any idea who you're talking to? And I was like, do you know what I do? No, you have no clue. And it's so sweet of you. But at the same time, I had this like, and it was a spiritual attraction, not a physical way. It was like I was drawn to this woman and I couldn't explain why, because she represented like everything that I understood was holy and not me or not anything that I wanted. But the maybe 8 times in that span of my life that I ever saw her, she would always say, Tracy, I'm really excited about your career and you're such a beautiful person, but you know, Jesus is going to use you. And I would always think, you are just so deluded, but it's okay because I love you. Then I go to California and KP, who I meet through like this cool music crowd, but she's not a druggie. She's got kids of her own. She's just like this ultimate cool person. She's like, hey, I want you to hang out with me. I have these friends that have been getting together on Wednesdays at Denny that we call it the Rock and Roll Denny's. And she said, we've been meeting there for 15 years.
I know the Rock and Roll Denny's. Yeah.
You know the Rock and Roll Denny's. So at that point for 15 years, and this was in 1989, they had been meeting for 15 years that Wednesday. Sometimes it was 4 people, sometimes it was 20 people. But this core group of women would come there just to share, to pray. I met people that were like weeks away from dying from cancer. I met women whose husbands were in the industry. They were not necessarily the industry related person. Some of the people were, and everything from acting to music, they were just all creative types or married to creative types. And their whole common thread was they knew this was a group of women that loved the Lord and believed in the power of prayer. And so I was tapping into things because I loved KP and I thought they were cool. But this third woman approaches me and she says to me, Tracy, you're beautiful. I'm so happy about your career, but Jesus is going to use you. And I'm thinking, you're as crazy as my friend in Brooklyn. You have no idea who I am apart from this table, but it's okay. But once again, there was this strong spiritual draw. And I didn't understand that what was going on, but like they were like these powerful intercessors, literally in opposite coasts, that took me on as an assignment. And while I was at my most corrupt, and I'm talking about lock me up, put me away, throw the key, how in the heck would Jesus ever look at me and say he was going to use me? And I really firmly believe that. So that was my response to them, whether I spoke it or not.
Right. And so what happened? How did you come to Christ? What was that process or what happened?
When I hit my very rock bottom, I was suicidal. And I'm not talking like amp it up suicidal. I was running around with these 2 young ladies. And they were young ladies that I'd met some night, like say we had a mutual friend at the club. And they were about 10 years younger than me. And they were so excited that it was Tracy Camilla Johns, the girl from the movie. And to be very honest, I didn't drive at the time. And they had a car. And I was like, sure. I introduce you to the world, no problem. So I was rolling around with these little girls who were like literally driving me around, and we were going to clubs and they were meeting everybody they wanted to meet. But I was like depressed. I was really depressed. The only person who really knew that was my then manager.
Were you depressed because you weren't getting many roles or because of?
No. Yeah. No work, no money, fame diminishing quickly. It became obvious, you know, how people stopped looking at you and how they now were looking at you. And then because my parents had stopped talking to me, at that point I was engaged. The engagement was broken off. I was literally being stripped one thing after another. And I couldn't buy a job. I couldn't buy a fiance. I couldn't buy a parent at that point in time. And I literally was at this point sleeping on my manager's floor. Because my stuff was in storage with my then fiance's family. And then we had called off the wedding and it was on the East Coast. I had come back to LA just scrapping, you know, trying to find something. I was offered a job. I screen tested for a host position on a now defunct show on BET, which at that time was huge. Black Entertainment Television was like just not even peaking yet, but it was huge. And I was so excited because this was the thing that was going to make my bail, so I thought, and it was going to revive my career and it was going to be my answer. And as they told me verbally that I got it, about a month later, I still hadn't heard anything. So I'm like, okay, there should be some sort of follow-up, but there's like this total shutdown. And I'm that total feeling in your body where you know something is very wrong. I literally was sitting in front of a TV and I watched a preview commercial and the other person they had actually hired. And that was the straw that just totally broke my heart and pushed me over. And I went on a binge then for weeks. Back to the two young ladies, the very last week preceding this whole major epiphany I had, I was running out, I was hanging out with them. And one of the young ladies said, my mom and I are going away for the weekend. If you would stay in our apartment, we would be honored. Please stay at my apartment. And I was like, cool, because I'm going to take your key and I'm going in there and I'm never leaving out. Like, she had no idea that I had already plotted that was where I'm going to go kill myself. Perfect setup. Wow. I'm in a place by myself and I'm not leaving out. So I gladly took the key. She and her mother went. There was a place and that was the urban celebrity spot back then. It was called Paradise. And it was Thursday nights. And you would literally see anybody from Prince to anybody that was on TV on any given night. And we would just go and dance till they open and dance till they close. I started at Paradise. I ended up in Santa Monica at this after hours spot, which is one of these unmarked door places. You know, you just had to know where to go. And daylight, I hopped a cab. I came back to her place and I locked that door with full intent to kill myself immediately. I could not find a knife sharper than a butter knife. There was nothing. There wasn't even baby aspirin in their cabinets. I'm doing this whole verbal negotiation in my head about how to take myself out, that I did not want anything to fail. Like, I did not want to wake up with a jacket on because I didn't do it properly. And then I'm going to be abused by whoever's in the institution. Like, I had this whole major dialogue. I'm going to have to do this right. And that's it. There was literally no way I could figure out that I had a surety of doing it. So now I'm now like several tabs of ecstasy, multiple types of alcohol to the wind. I'm sweaty. I'm funky because I haven't taken a bath since a day and a half before. And I started the whole club run and I am ranting and raving and I'm crying and I'm screaming. Like, I'm literally, and as close it was as just a drug paranoia to a mental breakdown, I am screaming at the top of my lungs in this little tiny apartment in Compton. The fact that the neighbors didn't call the cops on me is a miracle. But I'm pounding the room. I'm pounding the house. I'm pacing back and forth. And I'm cussing God out, though. The thing is, the whole dialogue is I'm cussing God out. I'm telling him, where are you? Like, every time I have called you, which is only about four times in the last 3 years, but whenever I have called you, you have made my bail. Like, somebody has shown up. Somebody paid the rent. Somebody brought me the answer. Where are you? And I was like, where are you? But what really was going on was I was so desperately afraid to go back out that door. Like, I had long violated everything that I said I was never going to do. Like, I'd made those lists of, you know, you won't do this, but you will do that. I had so compromised any remote value or moral or standard that I had once set two and three times over that I knew that if I did go back out to continue to live, even though I didn't understand spiritual things, I knew I was going someplace that I was not going to come out of. Like, I knew, and I had a greater fear of where I was going to go leaving that place than I was to just kill myself. And so even my motive in doing was just to end the pain and to end where I had arrived at. And so I passed out at a point in time. This literally went, so I started Thursday night in the clubs. It was Saturday afternoon when, and I'm still tirading. Like, every time I'm coming, I'm still cussing God. I'm reliving every moment in my life. I'm telling him the different places he showed up. I'm telling him then at this point in time about the women in LA. I'm telling him about the woman in Brooklyn. I'm telling him that they said you were going to use me. Like, I am talking the ultimate trash to God. What a dummy we are and how merciful and forgiving he is. So as I'm cussing him out, I remember, and to the point where I tell this story 30 years later and it still tears me up, I bellowed, if you are there, I will serve you at least as hard as I serve the devil. And the thing is, like, I don't have, even the words coming out of my mouth was just like a leading. I'm like, from the little bit of I had done, I've been in a couple of churches just to go to church with somebody, but I was there in like spandex pants and a leather jacket. And I'm sitting on the front row, really. And I'm in a church, like with my whole everything out. And I'm going, but they said these things. And if you are real, I promise, if you get me out of this one, I will serve you with every ounce of energy that I have served the devil, but you're going to have to show up and I'm going to have to know you're real. And I was screaming this. Like, I wouldn't dare do this to you right now, but I was screaming this. But when I finished that statement, and this is a physical experience I had, that I heard a woman who was a Russian Jew tell the same story, and it was translated, and I lost it because she had the same experience that I had that day. And I felt like, if you could say somebody the size of the Hulk came and surrounded me, literally this pressure enveloped me. And it was like a physical pressure. Now there is literally me in the room and this pressure squeezes me and it totally snapped my high. And then I'm like, oh, and at that point I cussed. So I said a few expletives right there. I said, God is really in this room. But as soon as I got that statement out, I cried from my toes. And I'm talking like a weeping that was like a purge of everything I'd ever done foul to anybody, anything foul anybody had done to me, every anger, every hurt, like everything I'd ever felt that needed to be set out of me was, I mean, I was bawling. But at the same time, when I collapsed this time, it was like a relief. And I woke up about 12 hours later. I felt like somebody had taken 20 pounds off of my body. And it was like, as I caught myself, I was like, God is real. I have no idea what's going to go on, but I know I'm okay. Like, I knew that if that thing, I knew what had happened to me. And I was like, nobody may ever believe me, but I know God is real. And literally that day, I put on jeans that I borrowed from the girl's closet. I did take a shower. I put on jeans. I put on a shirt. I left them a note. And I said, you know, thank you so much. You guys have no idea how wonderful it was to stay here. I'll talk to you soon. Because once again, this is before cell phones. The only people that I knew had cell phones at that point were Stevie Wonder. And they were big as my laptop at that point in time. So
that's hilarious.
I hop a cab and I go back into West LA, which is where I was staying on my manager's floor. Now, meantime, you know, the other side of the story is, my people that I did know, who did know I was depressed, which is like five people, they were about to call the cops at this point because it's now 3 days we haven't seen Tracy, no hide, no hair. And because of the state she was in, she's going to turn up in an alley. And like, we believe she's probably gone already. And so I walk in the door and they scream at the top of their lungs. They mug me and then they start smacking me.
They're like, where have you been?
That kind of thing. And, then my manager backs up and she goes, and Becca, this is the truth. I look different. Like when I looked at me in the mirror, I did not look like Tracy who went into that girl's apartment. She was like, what happened to you? I was like, I know you're not going to believe this, but I met God. Now see, because I don't know anything at all. I know anything about the word. Like I don't have even terminology yet to use. So all I could tell them was I met God. And she was like, I believe you because you don't look like Tracy. And she's like, all I care is that you're okay. Within a week, all the love faded because that's what happens, because people were like stripped immediately when they realized we've gotten over the joy that Tracy is okay. But like now she's a Jesus freak and she's a Bible thumper. What the heck has happened? And a whole bunch of other stuff shifted from there. Yeah.
And so what did happen? So did you move back to New York after that?
No, I stayed in LA. That was October. No. Yeah, it was October 16th, 1990. That is my official birth date in Christ, where I had this really profound supernatural experience. Over the course of the next 90 days, I went every Sunday at 6 a.m. to this little Episcopal church that was down the block where I lived in West Hollywood. And my manager lived around the corner from my previous roommate. I said I had gone to New York and then come back. And at that point, that's why I was sleeping on her floor. I knocked on the door. All of this happened within the first 7 days. This whole 7-day thing was amazing. So everybody's excited. I'm okay. I walk around the corner to go see my old roommate, and he had this quad that had multiple rooms in the different apartments. And I knocked on the door and I said, you know, and his name was Paul. I said, Paul, do you by any chance know anybody has a room? You know, I'm here in LA. I'm going to be here for a minute. And he's like, Tracy, one of my roommates left yesterday. He said, come on back. So like God had opened the door. So I had a roof over my head. And he was literally, work out the rent. We'll figure it out. I know you're good for it. You know, I lived with him for 2 years. So I did that. I had $11 left to my name at this point in time. I walked down the hall, and this was all, I did not know it was the Holy Spirit leading me, but I was literally having these dialogues because the same God who squeezed the high off of me and let me know that he was real. Every question I was asking in these first days, I would get an answer like immediately. So I'm like, okay. And I'm going, okay, God, so what do I do now? I heard him tell me, you buy a Bible. Now I don't read the Bible. I haven't read a Bible. Nobody has led me in doing this. I'm like, okay. So I walked down Hollywood Boulevard. There was a used bookstore on the other side of La Brea. And I get this Bible with like $2 left change. And I walk back to Paul's. I get my stuff out of my old manager's house and bring it around the corner, which is like two bags and a stick. And I bring it to Paul's. And my only assignment at this point in time is be quiet, because I felt like that was it, and go to this church. Now, the one thing I did do, which is hysterical to me to this day, is the second day, one of my other friends who would show up at the house to see if I was okay is like, I heard you all back, you know, da, da, da. And I said, we got to go to the club. And he's like, what? I said, no, we got to go to the club. I got to do this one thing. I got to go back. So it was another club we used to hang out to. So full of zeal, brand new Christian, goes to the club, orders a ginger ale, and tries to convert the bartender and all my little clubette friends, who all looked at me and said she finally took something that pushed her entirely over. Yeah, right. So I was not very successful evangelizing then. I didn't know that's what it was, but I was just so excited because physically I knew like I was different. Emotionally, like I didn't have any idea what was really going to unfold, but I knew that I had met God and this thing was going to happen. Within those 90 days, I ended up in a little town in Texas with two of the most powerful believers that I could have possibly met.
What town in Texas was it?
I was in Wichita Falls, Texas, which is a little teeny town in Texas.
Yeah.
And through a series of circumstances, that's where I ended up. And all I can tell you is, once again, just to, because so many people in my whole story, just privacy wise, just because it's also too, because it's 30 years ago. These people were absolutely sent to me to just disciple me, to teach me so many things. They were on fire for God. They had come out of the industries, like they had an understanding of the entertainment industry and sports and the different arenas that had been like, you know, where my friendship base was. So they understood me, and I'm still like stubborn. I'm still hard-headed as the Dickens. Like I'm still a firecracker, but I'm this person really seeking to know better that presence that met me in the room that day. And as a result of that friendship, now we're in the South. Now, Wichita Falls, Texas is like the real Bible Belt. We're talking about the Southern, yeah. Southern Baptist, but beautiful, anointed, very diverse communities of Christians. I did my first mission work as a result of this relationship. And because at that point in time, I was able to still kind of hustle enough income with a little bit of residual stuff. And at that point, because I didn't know what I was going to do, I had the liberty to say, okay, I'll go to the Philippines with you. You know, sure, let's go. I was very quickly inducted in some very powerful spiritual things. And I really think God's grace in my life is because I really didn't have any particular strong background. I was not raised in churches with great denominational, you know, restrictions or guidelines or beliefs. The things that were happening to me, I was like, well, this is just more of God. Like God showed himself to me supernaturally in the first place with nobody present or nobody like instructing me. So as I kept on having these encounters and as I was at the base of, you know, the Amazon jungle and, you know, we're at the same place where the Van Saints, you know, the famous missionaries who were killed there in the 50s who like birthed that whole, the Bible being produced in South America. There were just so many incredible things. So like supernatural healing was like, sure. There was nothing that you could tell me based on what I saw very early on and in a condensed amount of time that I was going to refute, because I had no reason to believe it wasn't real. I met people with prophetic mantles that told me about my life, that counseled me, and all they ever tried to do was lead me to Christ. Like it wasn't a bunch of hoopla. It was really some really profound spiritual experiences. And then I have my own. I did not drink from one day to the next. I did not ever have, like, I didn't even have the taste. And I was a drug head. I was a drinking drug head chick. And from one day to the next, I did not even have the taste nor the desire to do so. After my one visit to the club where I unsuccessfully evangelized, I never even wanted to do that anymore. Like it was like, and everything that I asked him to remove from me, he took. I used to cuss like a sailor. And in my total just ignorance and just pure belief that you can do that too, I was like, take this out. And I did not cuss. So like I had these kind of things happen to me in a very condensed amount of time. And I just continued to kind of try to be led. And I ended up back on the East Coast, which is where I still reside. And I've been here since 91.
Are you in New York or New Jersey?
No, I'm in what they call the DMV, the District, Maryland, Virginia, the Tri-State area.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right.
I'm close to the nation's capital. And that is literally where he planted me. And I have grown. That is where I've been this whole time, through many other experiences and a ton of growth, you know, because we never have it worked out. So should he tarry and I'm around here at 100, I'll still be figuring it out. But this is definitely where I was supposed to be, because life on this whole side of it involves so many of the other gifts and talents that I had being used to the glory of God. And it has been an amazing ride.
And what did your parents think of your conversion?
Okay. So initially, yeah, that was one of the things. There's still that, and that's one of the subjects which is emotional to me as far as heart, because I'm just still, there's a different level of belief and acknowledgement. I definitely, you know, I was a Bible thumper. Some of that because I really was, and you know, in my youth and not really having wisdom sometimes in what you share and what you tell people. I definitely had the experience where in my excitement, the day I first had the opportunity to sit them both down and graphically describe what I was doing before I came to Christ, really, Mom and Dad did not need to know all that.
But wow, I told them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I could see the hair on the back of their necks and then, oh my God, like ready to pass out. But then I was like, but it's okay because I'm here now. I'm okay. Jesus saved me. And I'm fine. But they were supportive of me because I was happy. They were supportive of me more because they agreed fully, but because they definitely knew I was spiraling out of control. They didn't fully know like what I then graphically shared with them. So definitely once they heard that, they were a lot happier. If they did not agree with all of my beliefs, they were happy because they knew I was healthy and that I was working on becoming whole, and that they did not worry that, you know, based on bad choices, you could end up checking out of here really much too earlier.
And so when you moved back to the East Coast, mm-hmm. did you just kind of jump into mission work, or what did you do once you moved back?
Initially, I didn't really do a bunch of church hopping. I went to one or two churches, but very quickly, because I was still a recognizable person, I was really trying to be prayerful. I was fortunate enough that I knew a couple of people that were very mature on the East Coast who really did disciple me. You know, they helped me. They, and because, you know, and as you know, I'm sure in anything that you've experienced since you've really committed your life to Christ, I had a whole bunch of cleaning up to do. And so certain things that were part of me, because I definitely was, you know, I love fame. I love the attention. I was used to dressing, as we call it here, dressed like a hoochie. You know, there were certain ways that that were all certain things immediately were like a transition, and others were always still being clean. And so I had to learn very quickly that you cannot speak at every church and you can't be interviewed by everybody, because everybody's motive is not pure. You know, really, you're a benefit in some places because you're the girl from the movie. And so if we say you're coming, then that many more people are going to come that night and the offering's going to be bigger. And I'm like, I'm so like no filter.
Right.
And I try not to be rough because I know some of the most amazing people on earth in the church and the body of Christ. And I am I am a prayer warrior, and I really, I love my life. I love my life in Christ, but you know, the reality side is people are human, and you know, we are flesh and we can go there. And so I really had to discern really what is God telling me to do? It was too easy even for me to fall into, everybody being happy to see Tracy. And it's like, I'm saying about Tracy, this is about the fact that Christ delivered Tracy. And in that, there are places that there will be doors open for me to go through. And there are going to be other places that even though it may sound good, it's not God. So I really, to the best of my ability, with the help of wise counselors around me, try to make sure that I was doing what God wanted me to do. And then because I really was called to be a teacher. Like, so some of the things my parents were trying to get me to go, they really did understand their child. So I do teach Bible study. I do speak publicly. I'm a very creative person still. So a lot of my artistic skills have been used to bring joy to other people creatively, but I really basically settled in this area. I ended up, you know, getting rooted in a body of believers in church home. And because I am a service-oriented person, which is the one thing I took from the industry, my greatest love was the fact that because I was Tracy Camilla Johns, I got to work with the Boys and Girls Club, or I got to go to a build, or I got to do these things for these different homeless shelters. And that is really one of my greatest loves and what I do now. I am a community service coordinator in this area, and I have a wonderful group of volunteers that range in age at this point from 8 to almost 80, literally. And we do everything from soup kitchens to we work with special needs kids with a very large entity called Keen that works with children with disabilities. And it's just to give the opportunity for them to be treated like whole human beings, and you know, like just no judgment, playtime. We work in gardens, we clean the streets, we host marathons. We do a lot with the military with COVID, with everybody having to be internally volunteering for a while. I made a lot of new relationships with places where we could do things virtually to meet the needs of another group. So I'm really living the dream now.
Yes.
And I'm living the dream now as a result of a little bit of the past opened some doors for me, but because I really did find who God really wanted Tracy to be, as opposed to what Tracy tried to make Tracy be.
Wow. And have you, just out of curiosity, have you had a chance to witness to Spike Lee?
Absolutely. Yeah. The last couple of years have been, because I really was like out, dropped off the radar, flying under the radar. Even when I did go to a number of things over the years, because this is still an area, the DM, you know, DC, because I do love the Kennedy Center and I do go to public events. I still was able to really fly under the radar. And as I'd mentioned earlier, like initially there was no internet. So now there is the internet, all these things that have happened in the last 30 years. And there's still until about 3 years ago, there were no pictures of me that were younger than 25 years old. I had managed to just not. And when people would take pictures, I'd say, please just don't post it. If you would just respect that, you know, from me. So it wasn't that people did not start to know that maybe I was in this area. It's just that they really respected my privacy. And then you also deal with sometimes when you start telling people about your relationship with Christ, they don't want to talk to you much longer anyway. And then you know, were just kind enough to respect that. So Spike reached out to me. We've had a very, very interesting relationship over the time, but we are definitely on excellent speaking terms now, but there was a long span of time where we did not communicate. So he'd reached out to me a few years ago when it was about to be the 30th anniversary of the movie. And through some promotional things he was gonna do, he was doing specifically a Moleskine book, and the Moleskine notebooks are something that he used all through school. And it's known that Spike Lee uses these to write, you know, his amazing works. Well, there was a special edition to commemorate the anniversary and also in honor of his mom. And it was in pink to tie into breast cancer. His mother died from cancer that had my face on the cover. But because he needed to get the rights to have my face on the book, we kind of re-entered communication. really kind of clear the air on a lot of time. And since that time, I've really been back in communication. But then what happened, what I did not know he also had to work in the works at that time was 18 months later, he was about to reboot She's Got a Habit as a TV series. Right. And what he wanted to do was have this great passing of the baton from the original Nola to the new Nola, which is what ended up happening. And so over the course of several meetings that we've had on and off since that first kind of reentry into our friendship, I've definitely witnessed to him. And what I really appreciate is that he has respected me in that I have seen clips and things when people do ask him about me now. He fully taught Tracy's a minister. Tracy loves the Lord. Like he really has very respectfully shared that, you know, this is the life she's living now. And this is what's happened to Tracy, because there was that definite, you know, people when they don't hear about you and because the internet is what it is, you know, you can speculate because unfortunately there are so many bad outcomes that, you know, like, well, what happened to her? We've never heard about her. We've never seen her. She never did anything again. It's like she fell off the face of the earth. But actually I was very actively living, but just this whole other life and lifestyle.
Wow. And so what is there a place where people can go, like in terms of supporting the ministry you're working in and, you know, help support that? Is there like a website or anything?
There's not a website. The one thing I will say is that I am part of a group of, I would say, even like we're a fellowship. You're talking about, we're still old school. And I'm sure we're going to probably ultimately have to really expand and expound. But, and also too, because I've also always very carefully navigated not wanting to be the source of anybody's attention. And not that I was any great, huge off the top star, but because I live in a very urban community and because there definitely is still, I still get recognized, which is always funny to me because people do the, I know you, you went to school, in Dayton. I go, no, you grew up in,
that's hilarious.
You grew up in Jacksonville. No. So I, you know, we go through it. Other times people just they go, oh my God, you look just like Tracy Camilla John. People tell me that all the time.
That's hilarious. Know.
So yeah, but just for like I said, out of respect of I really am, I'm a very, very strong believer that, you know, my life is not my own. And you know, the ministry that I'm with is very stable and stuff. And I just really believe people are led there. You know, they come there, they're not we're full to the rafters, we're not recruiting new members or anything. And to the best of the ability of all those involved, we just try to serve the community that we serve. And the funny thing is that I have had different straight jobs on and off throughout, you know, the span of time, because the sister still has to eat. And so, you know, and fortunately enough, I do have a roof over my head, but because I do a lot of outreach and I'm a volunteer coordinator, and in a volunteer coordinator, I am a volunteer myself and to a great capacity. I have had times where I've been employed someplace for years before anybody made the connection. And then when they did, I call it the deer in the headlight face. And they're like, Tracy. And they'll go, Tracy, how do you not tell me? And it's so funny because I was like, because it wasn't the point. It wasn't the issue. It was, I have never been employed any place that I don't think Christ did not direct me, because they've all been great mission fields. I have really had the liberty to be a person who just loves Christ and share. Yes, there are definitely doors that I've gone through that have been based on I'm the girl from the movie, but so many other times it has just been, you know, this nice brown lady who loves the Lord and she works with us. And, you know, she's really kind to our kids and she'll pray with you. And things happen when we pray together. And I'm so grateful for that. Like I still pinch myself. There is no, and I talk with my hands based on everything that is Tracy and my energy and my background. But I this energy is like genuine. I have such joy every day still. That I have been chosen. And like I said, the fact that he would look at me and use me, I said, God has a tremendous sense of humor. And he definitely always validates that he is God, because There's not too many people who knew me then who are not always amazed when they find out what has happened to me, because I was a hot mess.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm just like, I live in West Hollywood and I'm just like, God, how did you, why, how, me, you plucked me out of darkness and into light. Like, what happened? Like, you know, I'm still, like you said, I'm still blown away every day by it and just like in awe of God.
And then your testimony, and I think that you could, you know, and I guess I don't, if I can say this, and if it needs to be edited, I'm sure you will. But, you know, I am so excited about you, because I learned about you. And I just know it's just divine all the way around. I was reading something on CBN and I see this link about you and I go to read it because I'm a voracious reader. And I just love just testimonies of people, you know, that like, you understand me, I understand you. But your testimony was so powerful. And I immediately went to Audible and listened to your entire book. I inhaled it and dissected it and listened to it again. And just because I am an evangelist and because I have a large number of friends that I have a good number of friends that are Christian that have come out of a homosexual lifestyle or just a promiscuous lifestyle, you know, that's, you know, whatever it is, sexual sin or sexual issues being the root of what kind of kept them bound in the world, have come out. And then there are a lot that I do have the opportunity to witness to, a number of friends that are, and they're very dear friends of mine. And they understand what my stand is. They understand that I believe, you know, the scriptures. I believe that the deliverance is possible and available. I believe that Christ loves them just like he loves me, just like he loves anybody. He loves a bank robber. He loves a whore. He loves, you know,
prostitutes and tax collectors.
Please, please, all of us, all last one of us who, you know, of sinners, we have been chief. So I was just so touched by your testimony, because I was like, oh God, he gets it. He got it, first of all. Then he gets it. And then I was empowered by the book, because I just felt that much more equipped, because I firmly believe, you know, there's no one who's unreachable. You know, I'm not God, but I just believe if he took me, if he had a call and a plan for me, and I was able to be wooed by the Holy Spirit, the worst case scenario is people are going to still reject him. But I was just so encouraged by your story. And I was just super geeked that I'm here. I'm talking with you now. I am like total fan mode.
Well, I'm so thankful. Praise God that he saved you. Praise God that you are my sister in Christ. I'm so happy about that. And we're going to spend all of eternity together. But thank you so much for being on the show, Tracy Camilla Johns.
Thank you so much, Becca Cook. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, let's do it soon. And hopefully, you know, I'll get out to DC at some point and we can meet or hang out or something, whatever.
Or if when I get that way first, I will definitely let you know.
Yeah. So thank you guys for joining today. And we'll see you next week on the Becca Cook Show.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Becca Cook Show. Your support makes this content possible. All episodes of The Becca Cook Show are also available on YouTube. For more information about Beckett and his ministry, visit his website at beckettcook.com.
Hello, I'm Adam Comer.
And I'm Ryan Chittister.
And we are the host of Life After Addiction podcast. What we believe is that addiction is not a surprise to God.
That's right. We discuss addiction from a biblical worldview and how true freedom comes through a personal relationship with Jesus Christ.
Absolute freedom from addiction, the secular worldview of once an addict, always an addict, is just not true. If you or someone you loved struggles with addiction, subscribe to Life After Addiction at lifeaudio.com.